Today's special guest on Entrepreneurs Worldwide is an expert in the London property market. He has been at the coalface of the London skyline for over 40 years, working for Savills.
The diminishing opportunity of really high quality property, people aren't selling them, they're just holding them on for family legacy. So this year alone, you know, we've done an apartment for sale over in Hyde Park in the mid-50s, 50 million that is. We've done a penthouse in SW1 at 36 and a half million quid. There are examples of people, rich people, that have moved out of London and gone and lived in Milan. But they haven't sold in London. So they're expecting to come back. So we're not increasing the stock of second-hand properties.
What he doesn't know about property isn't worth knowing.
I think you'll find that if all the cities in the world, the international world cities, of which there are these half a dozen, London is still pulls in the most international investment. They want to educate their kids, you know, in the London market. You know, once you own in London, you know what? You own it under. You know, that's not always the case around the world.
He is currently head of super prime residential development for Savills. I read that London became, certainly in the last 20 years, a car park for dodgy money. How true do you think that is?
Well, I think it's probably spot on.
Please welcome Ed Lewis to Entrepreneurs Worldwide.
Hi guys, and thanks for having me.
The first question I want to ask you, is London still worth it?
Okay, so you're not going to pull your punches first up, then, are you? So, look, there are challenges in the market. I mean, it would be ridiculous to say otherwise. But, you know, London is a great world city. There aren't many world cities, you know, maybe New York, maybe Singapore, maybe Dubai comes into play. But essentially, people want to live and work and play in London. It has great cultural assets. It has an unbelievably good educational system. It has a great work pool, work ethic. International buyers aspire to be in London, want to educate their kids in London. There's a common language thread for lots of people around the world. To some international buyers who perhaps are, you know, trading in dollar-based currencies or track to the dollar, you know, it's good value in respect of the currency opportunity. And actually, you know, the market, you know, arguably, albeit expensive, you know, as we all know, arguably looks pretty good value in the long term. So I think London is a great opportunity. In my world, you mentioned the residential development. There just simply isn't that much also being built. And so the stock runs out. It's a difficult place to develop in.
But is there not much being built because the margins aren't there? There was a time when it was constant development. So there must be a reason why it slowed.
So you've got a number of factors. I mean, you know, a lot of prime central London that is listed, you know, in conservation areas.
Right.
You know, there are other property opportunities that come up. Maybe it's a commercial, maybe it's a hotel, maybe you're looking to build some of these amazing new clubs that they're building, whether it's grown-up clubs or kids clubs, you know, that can also compete for the space that perhaps a residential would have historically taken up. The problem with London, of course, is that I'm not entirely sure what the numbers are, but, you know, it needs to build sort of 70,000, you know, new homes a year, whether it's private or affordable. And we don't even touch the sides of that. Of actually, of recent years, I mean, it's fallen well below 5,000. Now, there are a number of reasons. I mean, debt's expensive. You know, I think that people were expecting it to come off, but post-COVID, it's been expensive post the Ukraine war, post obviously, whilst what's going on at the moment in the Gulf. But the time it takes for a lot of these developers to, you know, acquire land, whether they're piecing it together, the time it takes for them to get through the planning system, then the tragedy of Grenfell opened up a whole new set of legislation, which is obviously really important, but takes time. The length of time it takes to sell, the cost of material that they've got to put into their financial model is just making it very, very difficult and time consuming. And, you know, developers have got to build best in class in order to sell them.
I think a lot of people look at developers as something that is an instant process and they acquire, and then somehow months later, you've got this amazing residential development. Actually, what would you say was the average time period from a developer picking up a relatively large scale project to actual completion going onto the market? That is about 3 years.
You can probably add a nought. I mean, depending on the size of it, but I mean, I was first instructed on a nice scheme in Wandsworth called Riverside Quarter on the banks of the Thames, and I think we signed the instruction letter in 2002 at Lotsford Power Station, now called Chelsea Waterfront. Great scheme. Hutchison Whampoa, the developers there are Hong Kong-based. A property conglomerate. I think we were started in 2006. These are our big phased schemes.
Yeah.
So you've got to keep on your toes for an awful long time, and you've got to keep it fresh and interesting, you know, for people to come in to buy the next phase.
Ed, but from a developer's point of view, I know exactly where you're talking about that development on Lots Road. I mean, it used to be, I mean, it was just, what was it, a factory once upon a time?
So it was originally the power station for London's Underground, which, given today, there's a strike. No, wouldn't have been out of use today.
But that's a perfect example. That's washed out at least 4 to 5 developers, losing millions and millions and millions, and some of them going into bankruptcy administration. Until the Malaysian group, I mean, it was 30 years of a developer's graveyard on that site.
A little known fact, there are 80 million bricks in the power station. Who counted them? I'm not sure. But we first got involved, I first remember it, when John Broom was being sort of opened, you know, Red Ribbon with Margaret Thatcher wanting to do a theme park.
I remember that.
Then I think post that, a guy called Victor Wang, who was a client of ours from Hong Kong, who Parkville, who I remember going to see this amazing development they built right deep into the Hong Kong countryside. They picked it up. I think it might have then gone through a transition, and we did some work for, would you believe, Abramovich, who wanted to put Chelsea Football Club down there.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. On the basis that most Chelsea supporters actually go through Victoria Station. So actually, it sort of was quite convenient.
Yeah.
And then it went through a transition through the Irish, when the Irish
I remember those two, yes.
A company called Treasury.
Yeah.
You're right, I think they went bust, and Malaysian pension fund picked it up. And actually, to give it its due, it's a pretty incredible place. It's vibrant, it's lively, the shops are open, the power station.
Well, the team was awesome as well, building the tube there.
I think as well, it's a lot of the public don't, or people don't realise the development process when you're dealing with a listed building is so tedious.
It's also an enormous project.
It is, yeah.
And it's got commercial, it's got residential, it's got retail, it's got cinema, it's got everything that goes
with it. Do you know the ballpark of the money that was spent on
it? No, I don't know.
What do you imagine?
I would,
billions.
I think of a number, yes.
I think billions, yeah. I think up to a billion.
Just going back to the Lots Road development, it's somewhere that I pass all the time. And with my limited business hat on, when I see or any large development like that, I just think this is so risky. You need to have balls of steel.
I can give you an example of a block of flats on the park, on the Hyde Park, on the north side of the block, overlooking the south, 56 flats, and we're in our 12th year. I mean, that is ridiculous for 56 flats. Yeah. You know, so the process is so prolonged.
Yeah.
Now, the essential part of the financial model is to ensure you've got some early sales. So over the years, we've done early sales to the Irish. We've done early sales to Hong Kong, obviously, in Singapore. The Southeast Asians are very geared up for early acquisition. They understand the process. We still do an awful lot into the Chinese market. They want to educate their kids, you know, in the London market. We didn't use the word safe haven quite, but they also know that our political system, even though we feel it sort of goes, lurches from left to right, actually it's very benign. It goes to 5-2 and divide pass.
That's a good
point. It's a pretty safe place to be. You know, once you own in London, you know what? You own in London. You know, that's not always the case around the world. So there is a degree of protecting one's wealth in London. Now, I mean, you can talk about at the top end of the market, post changes to non-dom status, with increased stamp duty. You know, these are problems that we've got to navigate through. Now, there are examples of people, rich people, that have moved out of London and gone and lived in Milan. But they haven't sold. They haven't sold in London. So they're expecting to come back. So we're not increasing the stock of second-hand properties.
Well, look at all the people that have gone to Dubai. They haven't sold neither.
And they're on their way back. I mean, they can get out, they're coming back.
Because the education out there is appalling.
Well, whether that, I don't know the answer to that, but the lifestyle is quite limited. I mean, London, if you go to Milan or go to Dubai, I mean, Dubai is a fun place to be, but I mean, it doesn't have the seasonality, it doesn't have the culture. You know, they do their best. Yeah. But, you know, London is this incredibly magic place where you can turn it, you know, every corner there is something different. If you were buying, one of the things I tell our buyers, which they find incredibly frustrating, is that, you know, come into London with 15, 20 million quid, give us 3 days, we'll show you everything. 3 days to show us everything? That's ridiculous. If we take you to New York, it'll take us 3 weeks to show you everything. If we take you to Dubai, it'll take us 3 months. There's always another shiny tower that's better than the last one being built. That doesn't happen in London. So our customers, they come in, particularly the international ones, they look around 3 days, that's it. And then off they go. And then, you know, 6 months, 9 months, a year later, they come back, Ed, what else have you got to show in? Sorry, I've already said that we've shown you everything. They go away, come back another year later. Ed, what else is new? No. Let me explain. There is nothing new, okay? And then the penny drops and then they buy what's left.
Hence the word superprime.
Hence the word superprime. And so the pipeline of the superprime product is diminishing because of your point that, you know, it is very difficult to financially manage a superprime site, to find a site, to get the planning clearly in the conservation area or with the listing in the sort of golden postcodes. And it means that there are not that many new opportunities coming through. And that's sort of quite worrying for a world city, frankly.
What are the newest golden postcodes?
So traditionally, you would have gone into Belgravia, then Mayfair, then that sort of flipped on its side. So it's sort of Mayfair first, then Belgravia, then obviously Chelsea, Kensington. And then more recently, you know, Marylebone came from a sort of low base. It's now very cool. Sure. The high street's quite fun. It's got a bit of discovery in there. It's a better value proposition than those that want to be in Mayfair. Then you go slightly further west and you've got Bayswater, where you've got these unbelievable schemes coming up on Queensway. And you've got Park Modern, which overlooks the park. You've got the White Liz project, which was the old department.
What's it going to be?
So that's a block of unbelievably cool apartments with a Six Senses hotel.
Wow.
And that's the other thing that's changed over the years, that there are now, I'm not a great fan of branded residences per se, but there are a number of really good schemes that are attached to hotels, like the old War Office, they call the OWO next to the Raffles Hotel, or the Peninsula, which is on Hyde Park. And actually One Hyde Park, which had the Mandarin Oriental next to it.
Oh, my God.
Well, that was really, that was the Candy Brothers, wasn't it? It was one of the first, really, of its kind, sort of like super prime, if you like, in my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember they had all the road up. You couldn't pass under it, could you?
So it was originally Bowater House. It was a land securities building.
Yes, that's right.
You know, we were offering some advice to land securities. We said, build a tower, go for it. You know, they decided that an exit route was suited to them.
How did the Candy Brothers bounce into the market so strongly?
They identified a market that, if it's the most expensive, someone's going to buy it because it's the most expensive. Mm. Actually, they're unbelievably talented at producing an unbelievably good product. Mm. But it was a time, you know, particularly when the Russian market was, you know, London was open to the Russian market. They were piling in. They were making, you know, loads of dough quickly.
Are the Russians still about? Because I know they owned a lot of real estate.
So it's difficult for them to get. There are lots of Russians in London. There's the sort of next generations of Russians in London. But, you know, it's a complicated setup because of various sanctions. And you know, the oligarchs are no longer in town, of course, in America. I don't know if that's sort of true areas now, Israel or somewhere like that, but I don't know. But
so at the moment, as we stand, is it seen as still a wealth-building opportunity? Back in the day, I remember buying a flat and in 2 years it had doubled. Or is it somewhere just to park your money?
I think a lot of the needs-based market is where, you know, you've got another kid, you need another bedroom, you need a bigger garden, you want to move schools, and so therefore you need to move. And you can't do it as often because stamp duty is an expensive play, you know, particularly in the London market where a lot of the property is, you know, 750 and million pounds and plus, plus, plus. So I think the kids have got to make a decision which perhaps we didn't need to make because we could sort of you know, we wanted to live on the west side of the street, but I tell you what, we'll buy on the north side or the south side because we'll just wait for the west side to come up. And we could do that because stamp duty was running at 1%. And, you know, it was transactions were relatively straightforward. Interest rates were still quite high, but it was just a sort of different playing field, I think. Now, there is still a very strong needs-based market because the UK tend to want to be homeowners. If they can be, but it's difficult because I think the average age of a first-time buyer is something like 35.
This is
probably as you buy with your other half. Well, if you have another half, you know, or you get bank of mum and dad or bank of, you know, granny and grandpa to help you out because of the deposits. The international buyers see it as wealth preservation. The stamp duty might be 14, 15, 16, 17%, so a big sum of money. But if they're looking as a legacy buyer for 25, 30 years, actually, it's not the key factor. What they are worried about in London is crime. You know, worried about losing their mobile phone on Oxford Street or, you know, having a watch nicked outside Harrods. And that's a big deal.
Yes,
and that needs to get, you know, London needs to get a handle on that. But, you know, that happens in world cities, except that the UK seems to boast about it for some inexplicable reason. We seem to, you know, there was a great article written by, I think, the ambassador to London from Denmark or something. He just, you know, he said the great thing about the Brits is that they've got everything, but they keep on beating themselves up and denying it. You know, yeah. And it's ridiculous how we put ourselves.
What back. International money is the biggest buyers at the moment?
So there's a lot coming out of the Middle East, as you would suspect.
And where are they buying? They're going.
They'll buy in Prime Central.
Okay. Right?
They'll buy in Prime. They've got the pockets, you know, yeah. That allows them to do so. But they'll buy in Nine Elms, they'll buy in Battersea, right. You know, because they're much more at the now established area.
And I wanted to ask you about that.
The other ones, you know, already the Chinese, who are very strong, and Americans. So in the old days, we used to sell, you know, to an American who probably worked, you know, out of Citibank or something like that, who married, you know, an English girl and was buying a house in Kensington, and that, a few trades were happening. Now, I think something like 12 or 13% of the top end of the market are now to Americans. And,
really?
And they're a bit more visionary. Mm. You know, I mean, historically, yeah. Only 10% of them had passports. You know, everything happened yeah. inside, you know, American shores. Now they look out
and they do.
Into the world.
I want to just touch on that Nine Elms development, and not just that development. My son has just looked back in the day when I lived in Wandsworth. All along the river, there was just, do you remember the ship pub, right? There was nothing along there. That was it. I used to go to the ship pub. Remember all those flats along the river, Nine Elms, they're all much of a muchness. They must be very difficult to sell in the down market.
To some extent, they're a bit samey. I don't disagree with that. But you have to remember that the south side of the river was, you know, working wharves and nothing was happening to it. Not very well linked by transport. If it's okay, you know, when you get down sort of as far as the South Bank and you've got Waterloo and stuff. But, you know, actually that sort of Battersea stretch until, of course, they put in the Northern Line extension for Battersea. But a lot of it's quite inaccessible. The Uber boat that goes up and down the Thames is fantastic. There's no doubt about that. But that land needed, you know, to be developed. People like to be in new development.
Yeah.
Particularly they like their kids to be in new development, you know, because they've got security. Now, some of these schemes have unbelievable leisure. You know, they'll have a swimming pool or a gym.
Over the years, you've dealt with, you know, some hugely wealthy people and sold some, you know, very high ticket properties. What do you think are the business qualities that you need?
You really need to listen, you know, take some proper advice. You know, you need to make sure you've got the financial model and the patience, you know. You know, there are loads of challenges. We talked about the planning, but, you know, really making sure that you've got the best specification. They're really well thought out and designed, that you've got proper, you know, mature landscaping if you can on day one. You know, your parking's not perhaps as important now as it was 30 years ago, but parking back then would have been, you know, almost essential. You've got to have the right amenity to justify the service charge. I mean, the service charge, you know, they creep up and cost of staffing creeps up. Security is important and staffing tends to be mixed in with that. Bars like a sort of lock up and go, it tends to be low maintenance, it's going to be on a long lease. I think if there was one thing they've got to get right is the security and just good design.
You originally created and started and built the London development cells, effectively, mm-hmm. floor, that machine, heading up, 150 people.
Mm-hmm.
and you've gone on to do super prime. Savills is an extraordinarily well-known, worldwide, prestigious real estate market developer, agent, call them what you will. Why you?
I like them. We're pretty good at our job, you know. Savills has a very, very good...
I ask you, not me.
I know, but you can't do it by yourself. And, you know, I just happened to be in the right seat, you know, for a lengthy period of time. You know, there was a lot of development, great development going into London. In the early 90s, the London market was flawed. The Singaporeans, for instance, decided that they would come in and park buy into places like Point West and Kensington Green, I think it was. And suddenly it was a Singapore market. Then we moved in to sell to Hong Kong. Then we thought, hold on a sec, this is quite fun, but try the Irish.
Yeah, there is a lot of money in Ireland.
Oh, haven't you heard? I think Israel and Republic of Ireland were the first out of the 2008 recession.
Well, they might have gone into it by then, because I think they probably went, they were really fizzing late 90s into the 2006, 2007, I think, is where they had their problems. So the banks were lending 110%,
120%.
You know, how much do you want? And let me lend you even more. So, you know, it was an unbelievable time. They were buying in London, of course. They were also buying in places like Portugal and Spain, I guess, other places around Europe. And then we did the same thing in South Africa. The rand was getting more and more expensive, but they thought, well, if the rand keeps shifting out, we need to get in early. And they've got obviously very close links with the UK. So we did a lot of sales into Joburg and Cape Town. And as I say, more recently back into China. And obviously we didn't miss out the Middle East on the way through. And all this traveling we did was incredible, you know, including places like Moscow when it was acceptable to do so.
Also, you've got the large families. I mean, you look at the streets of London, you've got the Duke of Buccleuch that owns large areas of real estate. You've got Crown Estates, Cadogan. These are old British families that made their money in, whether it's Prohibition or where they made their money in some bringing air conditioning into the UK from America. Whatever they did, they earned a lot of money. Where are they now in the layout of London?
I mean, people like, you know, Grosvenor, obviously, you know, they really manage their estate unbelievably well. So if you look at how they've, you know, developed Elizabeth Street, for instance, when we first started doing Chelsea Barracks, which was, you know, that's 12, 15 years into Chelsea Barracks, and I believe another 12 or 15 years to go.
Have they all sold it?
No, we've still got a lot to sell and a lot to build. But it's a really well-managed development. And the reason they can sell it as a phase, because they'll go and build the shell of the next phase. So the existing residents won't be disturbed by the build of the next phase. I mean, there will be work to be done inside. Now, back in the day, you might say that Chelsea Barracks was slightly on the sort of periphery of Belgravia. Now, I reckon it's right in the heart of it. So it's sort of shifted, or something shifted to it. And that area around where Daylesford's went in Pimlico, we used to call Pimlico Green, I think it's now Orange Square, is a really cool, quaint patch. Cadogan, on the other hand, you know, did exactly the same thing in Pavilion Road.
Isn't it cool?
And then we talked a bit earlier about Marylebone. So Marylebone was always a sort of weaker, poorer relation of Mayfair. And that's the Harold de Walden estate. And they curated a really interesting ground floor and high street space. And what they did is add a lot of money upstairs, because they owned upstairs. But by creating a really interesting ground floor, it's easy to add upstairs. Now, on the other side of that coin, you know, you've got lots of the high streets in London that are, you know, frankly full of, you know, I'd say hairdressers, that's probably the wrong phrase, but, you know, nail bars and, you know, phone shops. And, you know, that's not a very exciting, high street experience, because they're all different landlords, and therefore they can't curate what's going on the ground floor. On Queensway, where we talked about the Whiteley at one end and Park Modern at the other end, there is a collaboration of stakeholders that are trying to piece together a far more interesting experience of Queensway. So you might think in 10 years' time, 5 years' time, that Queensway starts looking like Marylebone High Street. So they really are developing that. And of course, Queensway, being the north of the park, has always been that sort of slightly poorer district to the residential in Mayfair, which is obviously to the east, or Kensington to the west, or Knightsbridge to the south of the park.
I read that London became, certainly in the last 20 years, a car park for dodgy money. How true do you think that is?
Well, I think it's probably spot on. But London allowed itself to be so. I mean, it wasn't illegal. We probably take the strongest approach to that than all of the other component parts. And rather strangely, we're the ones that don't take the money on the way through. So, you know, the solicitors take the money, the banks take the money, Savills, you know, and others like us, you know, don't actually handle any of
that. No, I get that.
Yeah, we have to do the strongest checks.
Yeah, I get that.
We have to be very comfortable with the source of wealth.
Yeah,
and rightly so. But, you know, historically, London was, you know, somewhere where people preserved, stored wealth, safely.
The lifestyle aspect, I think, is incredibly important for developers now, creating a destination for where you live and work, because now that everyone's living and working in the same location.
So a lot of people are wanting to work from home, but a lot of people don't necessarily want to work inside their front door, so you create work spaces within a scheme, but is outside your own demise. At least you feel as if you're going somewhere. Yeah. But I mean, actually, I think there's much more pull into work.
Do you know, I often think to myself, given that the world is becoming more and more reduced in its actual land availability within the major cities, you wonder if they're ever going to tax air, the actual space around the building or something.
Well, they do in a sense. I mean, there are restrictions on height, you know, and it's quite difficult to build, you know, towers. You know, there are complications around height post-Grenfell. Not everybody wants to live on the 30th floor. I mean, it's not necessarily a London, UK thing, you know. I mean, as I say, if you live in Hong Kong or in Singapore or Manhattan or in Dubai, you know, your perspective, I mean, I don't particularly like heights, I'm probably not the right person to ask, but your perspective is, of course, you're looking across at some other building. In London, you can be on the 6th floor and you're over the top. Mm. I mean, but I love the cluster in the city. I think it's really sort of, I like the cluster in Nine Elms, actually.
You are selling right at the top end, super prime. Can you actually talk someone into spending 15, 20, 25 million on something?
If you count to a million, it'll take you 11 days. Okay? If you count to a billion, it'll take you 30 years. Okay? There are people around the world who have got very deep pockets, who are earning incredible amounts of money very quickly. And in a sense, the value of that money is perhaps different to our generation, and definitely different to our parents, and way different to our grandparents' generation of how they built their money. London is a diminishing opportunity of really high quality property. People aren't selling them, they're just holding them on for family legacy. So this year alone, you know, we've done an apartment for sale over in Hyde Park in the mid-50s, 50 million, that is. We've done a penthouse in SW1 at 36 and a half million quid.
Is it consortium?
No, they'll all be private. They'll be Middle Eastern, they'll be European. The apartment at Chelsea Barracks was Chinese. An American bought a peninsula at 23 quite recently. You know, I mean, it's around the world, but it's also domestic. You know, there are also buyers that are living, working, you know, have always done so in London, able to afford that as well. You know, the air is thin up there, but these deals do happen.
How does London compare to other major global property hubs in terms of an investment opportunity? Do I got 25 million, do I invest it in London or do I put it in New York?
Well, you'd probably be doing both, frankly. Right. So I think you'll find that if all the cities in the world, the international world cities, of which there are these half a dozen, London is still pulls in the most international investment.
Well, that's nice to hear.
That is actually.
And look at the new hotels there. Well, look at the restaurants. The cost of living is scary. We know that. But every time you try and get a restaurant booking, you know, a half decent restaurant, you know, you've got to wait months.
I know, it's bizarre. It's bizarre. Another question I want to ask you, stamp duty, even at the high level of 7%, the highest level of 7.5%, is it for?
Well, it's a lot of properties over 300. It's a progressive upward scale. So
yeah, but if you want
to talk, about a million plus,
is that
9-10%?
Is it really?
And if it's your second home, okay, or your, you know, non-primary resident, it'll have a surge.
Okay.
If you're an international, it'll have another.
Okay, so you said earlier on, in our chat, you said that people tend to hang on to the properties because of the stamp duty. They can't keep moving around all the time. So would it be a good idea for them to drop the stamp duty for everybody to get everything moving?
I mean, obviously, I would say yes. I mean, it's a really bad tax, you know. But it just feels an aggressive tax, you know, not unfair tax, but there are plenty of those out there as well on that. So what happened, and I think this was George Osborne who changed the stamp duty strategy, and then, you know, over the years people have added to it, you know, and unfortunately it hasn't sort of derailed the market, you know, so the international buyers will still come in because they'll probably be offsetting against a currency play, or, you know, they're buying for 25-30 years. But what it doesn't help is, you know, young kids trying to get into the London market. There'll be lots of other places in the UK where actually stamp duty isn't relevant at all because it's, you know, it's been
you say it hasn't derailed.
We sit in London, and that's where it hurts.
You say it hasn't derailed the market, but I know for a fact that that's what keeps me stuck in this house, for sure, because I don't want to fork out again. So there's revenues that the Chancellor could have had from me if it was a bit lower. That's my point. And I can't be the only one.
But the trouble is that those aren't the numbers. So, you know, the numbers are that there is more intake of taxation through stamp duty than there was before it went up. So, you know, it's a difficult argument. I totally agree with you, which is why you're not moving every 7 years, you're moving every 15 years.
You have worked for Savills for so many years. How has that shaped you?
Richard very kindly sort of threw a curveball first question about, is the London market shot? No, I mean, turkeys do not vote for Christmas, right? Okay, but the reality is that, you know, Savills has given me an unbelievable platform to see some unbelievable property, to work with some unbelievable
people. What's your favourite one you've ever seen?
It's a scheme in Painter's Yard, called Painter's Yard. It was an old plumber's warehouse.
Where's that?
Old Church Street.
Okay.
In the heart of Chelsea, in Old Chelsea, which I think is a lovely part of town. And it was just with these incredible apartments sort of hidden away, behind, nothing on the street, as it were, it was all behind the street. So it was a great scheme. But there have been other great schemes. I particularly like the schemes that have got some heritage. So, you know, they're building around some heritage. So it's not just new build, but they can link it into a heritage building. We were about to launch a scheme in the St. John's Woods or St. John's Wood Square, which is called the original King's Troop Riding School, and everything's being built around it. And it's just a lovely centrepiece to have, which they're making into this incredible amenity.
One of our entrepreneurs, he's just acquired a house. Needs about 7 million spending on it. He's acquired a house for 15 million in Chelsea. It was on for about 23 million. Is it a good time to buy now? And has it come off 20?
Yeah, so the stats are 20-21% since the tail end of 14.
Okay.
And then if you're buying in the dollar, I mean, the dollar's more expensive now than it was, say, 18 months ago. So, but it's still pretty cheap historically. You know, you are getting a double whammy. That's the biggest discount, not always the best deal. Okay, so something maybe overpriced. But I do think that pricing is probably the most important part of it. You know, my kids are selling a property. You know, one of them's very in the local market. They priced it, had three viewings, three offers, went to seal bids. Now, you could say, well, actually, maybe it's slightly underpriced. Well, I think they probably got a spot on. So, pricing is incredibly important. If you price it too high, it's like catching a falling knife. A lot of people don't want to deal with builders, per se, you know, or just estimate the cost of the project and definitely estimate the time it takes to do these things.
Is there any definitive reason why, if that is true, that property on the whole has come off 21% since 2014?
It was just a series of events. Now, London tends to be a world beneficiary of disruption. You know, so if there's a war going over there, a lot of people like the safe haven of London. So it tends to be a beneficiary. We don't shout out about it because it's not really appropriate to do so. But, you know, at some point you'll find that London, you know, and it really does take off. And therefore, I think it is a good time to...
You're on death row. Time's up, Ed. What is the music you're playing and the food you're eating?
Well, I'd probably get a River Cafe takeout.
No.
or a chicken pie. I'm not sure the music. I think it'd probably be Dylan without Bobby Kilmer before they did.
I love it. Wow, what a wealth of knowledge you've had over 40 years working at the coalface of the London property scene. And thank you so much for coming into Entrepreneurs Worldwide. Ed Lewis.
One thing we've learned on Entrepreneurs Worldwide podcast is if you are a budding entrepreneur or you're building a company, you need to
give it 1,000 days.
Thank you, Ed, for coming on.
Can you do us a favor? Can you hit that follow and subscribe button? You can find us anywhere where you get your podcasts on Entrepreneurs Worldwide. And there'll be a new episode every Wednesday at 5 a.m.